MacCast, Saturday, March 1st, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, this is going to be a good show for you this week. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. I was surprised, actually, how much I have in the show notes. We've got some new information coming to light about the screen in the iPhone 6, and no, it's not just about the size. Also, an update on the SSL bug that was impacting Apple this past week, along with some OS updates to go along with that. And Apple TV may no longer be a hobby for Apple, or so says one of Apple's top executives. You probably can guess who. Got all of that and a lot of follow-up. We're going to follow up on the database conversation we had last episode, address a FireWire issue in OS X Mavericks that is impacting some users. And I'm going to go on a little rant again about my feelings on the Mac App Store. That and a whole lot more. We got lots of stuff to get to. It's going to be a lot of fun, so stay tuned. But before we get into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Lynda.com. I've been telling you about Lynda.com over the last couple episodes. I think it is an awesome service. Just in case you don't know about Lynda.com, they offer high-quality video courses that can help anyone learn creative software, business skills, all kinds of skills, actually. There's over 2,000 different courses that you can choose from, and they're constantly updating and adding new courses daily. I'm a web developer on the side, as well as being a podcaster, and I love using Lynda.com to kind of keep up to date, stay up with my skills, and even learn new techniques and tricks. And what's awesome is they have a great search functionality. They have everything categorized, so I can jump in there. I can find the tutorials that I'm looking for. Just search some keywords. Say I want to know about some sort of new JavaScript framework. I can search for that, find out if they have a video. Really easy. And I like to just explore around on there from time to time. I was actually doing that this week. And if you want to go beyond just learning something new, I discovered they have this great section of what they're calling documentaries, and specifically creative inspiration stories. So I like sometimes to just get inspired by the work and the things that other creative people are doing. And they've got some really great creative people. These are their instructors showing you or talking about the kind of work that they do. So folks like Burt Monroy, Rick Smolin, and Vaughn Glitschka. And you may or may not recognize Vaughn's name. Vaughn is a great illustrator. I actually worked with him. I had the pleasure of being able to work with him when I was at Upper Deck, the trading card company, for a few years. And he's actually the guy who designed the Mac Roundtable album art. So if you listen to the Mac Roundtable, you've seen Vaughn's work. And he has a really great one of these documentaries, these creative inspiration stories, where he talks about his processes and the stuff that he does. And best of all, like I said, these are the instructors at Lynda.com. So not only can you get inspired by them, but you can also learn from them as well. Really, the best way to experience it is to check it out. So I really want you to check it out. And I have a deal for you. You can get free trial access to the entire library, everything in that 2000 plus course collection at Lynda.com, just by going to Lynda.com/MacCast. And when you go there, you'll see that I've put together a playlist with some courses that I recommend you can get started with, Mac and iOS related courses, things that I've found interesting. So you can start checking those out, but also go off and just explore on your own. And then when you're ready to sign up, they have full access plans starting as low as $25 a month. And they also offer gift subscriptions. So if you look at it and you think it might be perfect for a student or a family member in your life, someone needing to extend or expand their skills, you can get them a subscription as a gift. It'd be an awesome gift to get. So just go to Lynda.com/MacCast. There you'll find out all the details about the service, all the various plans that they offer. That's Lynda.com/MacCast to get all the details. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I think probably the most prevalent rumor we've heard about regarding the next iPhone so far is that it's going to have a larger display. We've been talking about that a lot. Somewhere between 5 to 6 inches, depending upon whose story you read. I'm really personally hoping it falls more in that 5-inch range. I don't relish having a larger than 5.5-inch iPhone. I just think that's too big. Those gigantophones, as my friend Mac OS Ken's Ken Ray calls them, just way too big. And so we've had that rumor for a while, and it's probably followed next only by the rumor of Apple moving from Gorilla Glass in its displays to Sapphire Glass. That's reportedly going to be produced at a new plant run by GT Advanced in Mesa, Arizona. Apple helped fund that plant. And as a matter of fact, one smartphone manufacturer recently claimed that they could not get a hold of any Sapphire displays for their phone because Apple had supposedly locked up the entire supply of Sapphire Glass. Haven't been able to confirm if that was accurate or true or not, but it was thrown out there. And I believe that Apple's been putting a lot of money into Sapphire Glass. They can produce a lot of that stuff. And I think they're going to be using it in everything from the smartphone displays to potentially their new wearable product. Also, we already know they use it for the Touch ID glass as well as the lenses on all of their products. So they certainly have applications for it. But this week, a report from Forbes says that Apple is also making displays that are going to be more accurate and have better color reproduction using quantum dot technology. This is technology similar to what Amazon used in their recent Kindle Fire HDX 7 displays, and that was actually the display that beat Apple's Retina iPad mini display in some of the recent DisplayMate tests. So the iPad displays were always on top when DisplayMate would run through and do their testing. This time around, Kindle had beat out Apple, and it sounds like they want to get their crown back. Apple's new quantum dot displays will reportedly one-up Amazon's because they're going to focus not only on color reproduction accuracy, something that Apple or that Amazon went after exclusively, but Apple's also pushing to make sure that the displays meet their strict color gamut standards. Apple's always been really critical about making sure the color gamut in their displays is excellent, and so it sounds like they're going to combine those two things. The new display technology is said to be coming from a company called Nanosys. They have Samsung as one of their major investors, and the company, Nanosys, actually holds over 300 patents related to quantum dot technology. So this would be the company to go to if you're trying to do that sort of thing. The company would not confirm officially that they were working with Apple, but the CEO did say recently that their technology could be used in smartphone displays. I guess there were some people out there saying that it wasn't possible to get the technology down that small. We've seen it in tablets and also in like televisions and larger displays or monitors, things like that. But the CEO did say they will have their first smartphone with a quantum display ready for launch mid-year, of course not naming any manufacturers. There's also been some recent rumors that claim Apple could launch the iPhone this June, which would tie in with that mid-year time frame. The thinking being that this time around, Apple wants a little longer lead time to ramp up supplies of iPhones as they move into the holidays to meet holiday demand. Launching it in the fall has been a problem for Apple because of the popularity of the iPhone. They sell out and then they don't have more units to sell. They just can't keep up. So this would give them a longer lead time going in. And that makes a lot of sense. To me, it seems like it would be a little bit early. June might be a little bit early. July, maybe August, more for a launch time frame, kind of splitting the difference maybe between the fall and the summer. You know, Apple was on that summer release schedule, and then they moved to the fall one. Sounds like they might be pushing back the other direction, at least according to some of the more recent rumors. Forbes also pointed out that Apple recently filed 4 different patent applications that deal with improvements to quantum dot technology, and they focus on eliminating some of those compromises between color saturation and accuracy in the technology. So that gives a little more legs and credence to this rumor. So bigger screen, better glass, better color it's sounding like the iPhone 6 is shaping up to be really, really nice and a nice jump forward on the display technology. Some of the other things we're hearing rumored about that might show up in the iPhone 6, Broadcom announced that they have a new 5G Wi-Fi multiple input, multiple output MIMO system on a chip designed for smartphones that can bring 802.11ac connectivity to those devices. And a lot of people have been wondering when Apple's going to add 802.11ac to their mobile devices. It sounds like the iPhone 6 could be the first one to get it. The timing is right for this new Broadcom chip. Apple uses Broadcom for their chipsets for wireless connectivity. So that's a good sign that we could see it in this next iPhone. And that's some of the latest rumors on the iPhone 6. Had one other story related to the iPhone 5S, and this is good news for those of you who have been having issues with your Touch ID sensors. We're hearing that Apple might have a fix ready soon for what's being dubbed the Authentic Fade issue in Touch ID. Authentic is the company that makes or pioneered the technology that Apple has rolled into the Touch ID sensors, and many people have been reporting that the accuracy of their Touch ID seems to get less and less over time. As a matter of fact, a number of you have actually reported that problem to me as well in your emails and your comments and things like that. Well, Apple Insider is reporting that Apple is readying an update that could fix that problem and that that update could be out fairly soon. They don't give an exact time frame, but I would assume in the next coming weeks. Until then, there are a couple workarounds you might try. One thing you could do is just simply reset up the fingerprints for any of the fingers that you're having trouble with. Just go into the settings and redo them. Another trick that has been recommended is that you set up the same finger in multiple slots. You know how you can have five different slots for your Touch ID, so you would use the same finger on two or three slots, basically increasing the chance that you're going to get a good recognition. And then I also received an email from Josh this week, one of our listeners, who said that he was able to resolve the issue by actually going in and turning off the animations and reducing motion in the settings on his iPhone. I'm not sure exactly how those things are related, but he said it did work for him, so it might be worth a shot if you've been having issues with your Touch ID. Go into Settings, General, Accessibility, and turn on the Reduce Motion option. He said that after doing that, he was able to get Touch ID accuracy increased to about 99%, so 99% of the time it's working. Only bummer is you're not going to have any of those cool animations in the user interface, but iOS will probably feel a little bit snappier to you because it's not having to take the delays to actually do those animations. A lot of people like to turn off the motion just to have the iOS be a little bit quicker and more responsive when you're launching and running through the interface. But you might give those a couple you might give those tricks a try until Apple actually releases a updated fix. And speaking of bugs, Apple had quite a big one that they had to deal with over the last couple weeks. The past week or two has been consumed with stories about a serious security flaw in Apple's SSL implementation, both in iOS and in Mac OS X. And it's something that affected any app that would use SSL. So applications like Mail, Safari were all prone to this problem. And the problem was simply a line in the SSL code that read go to fail. And that line was duplicated twice, but it caused a huge, huge problem for Apple. And that's where the name came from, go to fail. It's being called the go to fail bug. And it was that second line that was basically opening a door for hackers to exploit and potentially get at your sensitive data. Now, there were some conspiracy theories flying around, but I think this, to me, looks purely like a developer simply made a copy-paste error, and it just somehow got missed in QA. And that might be the bigger cause for concern, is how did something like this slip past Apple's QA process for so long and in so many places? But basically what it meant is that SSL could be tricked, the secure layer could be tricked by a hacker so that if they were on the same network as you, say at a public Wi-Fi hotspot, they could actually hijack and potentially monitor your traffic, getting things like passwords and banking information and stuff like that. Now, Apple quickly patched up iOS 7. They pushed out an update, but they waited until the release of macOS 10.9.2 to actually patch the Mac. And that was a little bit curious. It came, I think, a week or two almost after the iOS 7 update. Apple has also issued updates for macOS 10 Lion and Mountain Lion, which were also affected. Unfortunately, Apple is no longer updating Snow Leopard, and that caused a little bit of an uproar because Computer World reported that roughly about 19% of Mac users were still on Snow Leopard, and they were spinning that as a huge issue, that Apple was ignoring that part of their user base. Well, luckily, we've got Peter Cohen, really smart guy over at iMore, calling BS on that story. And the reason is that Apple has not retired Snow Leopard. As a matter of fact, Snow Leopard is alive and well and still available for sale in the Apple Store if you want to go pick up a copy. And what's more, the real deal with Snow Leopard is it likely just didn't have the bug in it, so Apple didn't need to patch it. It was the newer versions of the operating system that had this go-to fail bug. So nothing more nefarious than that, but you know, the internet loves a good story title that's going to draw traffic, and link baiting is ever prevalent and still in effect. So, you know, take your stories with a grain of salt and make sure you're checking multiple sources before you jump to any conclusions from any one source. But bottom line is the operating systems and iOS are all patched up. So if you haven't grabbed those updates on all of your Macs and devices, you want to do that as quickly as possible just to keep yourself protected. Always staying up to date on software updates is a good thing. And I recommend you go run those updates now. Stop the podcast if you need to. Go run those updates now and grab them. Now, there is also another iOS bug that's being reported about this week, this time from network security firm FireEye. With this one, they claim that a maliciously crafted iOS app could actually run processes in the background that could log touch events and button presses in other apps. So basically, it would be a maliciously crafted app that you would download from the App Store, and then it would, as it was running in the background, start to log and record button presses and things that you were doing in other apps, and then remotely send those back to a server all behind the scenes. Now, note that in order for this to work, the app would actually have to get past the App Store review process, something you would hope wouldn't happen, but FireEye claims that they've developed approaches to do exactly that. And Ars Technica claimed that they discovered a blog post from FireEye claiming that they had successfully delivered an actual proof of concept monitoring app through the App Store that could record the activity and send it back to their remote server, and that they had been collaborating with Apple to actually fix the issue. Now, the blog post has been removed, and I don't think there was any kind of copy of it. Often when a bug is reported to Apple, if any kind of posting has happened publicly about it, Apple will ask the company to actually pull down that information until they can actually issue a fix. So it's very likely that they've reported it to Apple, and Apple is working on a fix for this one. But until then, you know, the same sorts of things always apply. Make sure when you're downloading an app from the Mac App Store that it's from a trusted developer and you know a little bit more about it. Basically, just do your research. Make sure you know that you're downloading good apps. And, you know, the community's done a pretty good job of self-policing and finding any apps that might be running stuff maliciously in the background. Remember when we had that whole rash of applications that were sending back contact data and information, and we found out about those pretty quickly. So I think we would know if an app actually slipped through and was still actively being sold and downloaded on the Mac App Store that was exploiting this bug. So don't have to worry about too much. It sounds like Apple's on the case, and it should be fixed probably in the next iOS update. And as I just mentioned, Apple did release OS X Mavericks 10.9.2, the update. It fixes that critical SSL bug I was just talking about. But it also brings FaceTime audio support to the Mac. Actually, that's something I just started playing around with on my iPhone. As a matter of fact, I made my very first FaceTime audio call with Ken Ray from macOS Ken today, or this week, I should say, and it sounds awesome. It's going to be a really good option, and Apple puts it front and center on your iOS devices. If you go into contacts, when you press the phone button, it actually gives you the option to make a standard cell phone call or to use FaceTime audio with those people who support it. And what I didn't know that was really cool was when Ken called me, it actually was my standard ring. I figured I would get the FaceTime style, ring, but it actually came through as a standard ring. So I just picked up the phone and it sounds much better than the cellular data connection. So it's going to be nice to be able to actually make those FaceTime audio calls directly to and from the Mac as well. Another new feature that's in the 10.9.2 update is messages will now let you block iMessages from specific senders. I've never really had a spam problem with iMessage, but I would imagine if I did, that would be a nice little feature to have in there as well. Big one that a lot of people are going to appreciate is Apple did address several macOS 10 mail issues. There's a lot of fixes in there. There's a fix to bring more accurate unread counts. Also a fix for a bug that prevented mail from receiving new messages from certain email providers. I know we talked about that one on a recent MacCast and some possible workarounds, so that should be fixed. Also, better compatibility for Gmail stuff, specifically Gmail archive inboxes and also Gmail label improvements, and general improvements in stability for the compatibility of mail. In addition, 10.9.2 fixes an issue that may have caused audio distortion on certain Macs. That was also a thing that we covered, and I have confirmation from at least one listener that it did fix the USB audio distortion issue he was having. This was something that impacted specifically Macs with Fusion drives. And also there's a fix in 10.9.2 that addresses an issue that could have prevented certain preference panes from opening in system preferences. Now, despite the release notes and all of the fixes, some folks are reporting that their mail troubles aren't completely gone. There's been reports on Apple's discussion boards of several issues still remaining. Specifically, a number of people are saying that when they go to check their Gmail accounts, the system is just completely hanging. There's also issues with management of messages and smart folders being reported, and also just general crashing and other problems. Some people do claim that simply deleting and recreating any IMAP accounts can solve the issues, but that fix does not appear to be working for everyone. So it's something worth giving a try, but you could continue to have mail issues. So it sounds like Apple may have a little bit more work to do on the mail front, at least for some users. We don't have a lot of details on specifically what's happening. So if you have been or are still experiencing rather issues after upgrading to 10.9.2 with your mail, let us know about them. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com, and maybe we can get some sort of idea of maybe some common patterns or something for those of you who are still having issues. There's also been some reports that some people are having AirPlay issues after running the update. The issues seem to be varied, but almost all related to the AirPlay mirroring functionality. In some cases, the functionality is completely missing after running the update, so where you could use AirPlay mirroring before, suddenly you just don't have the option up in your menu bar anymore. Others are reporting that there is a scaling issue on both the Mac and the Apple TV display. Also reports of low frame rates and sporadic mouse freezing, as well as complete video failures. So like I said, a whole host of different issues related to AirPlay mirroring. It's not exactly clear what causes the issues either, or specifically which Macs are impacted, but a lot of the early reports seem to be indicating that the issues are more likely to surface if you have an older Mac or older Mac hardware. So again, if you've been impacted by this, let us know about it. And we'll try and see if there's any kind of common thread. And if there's any more information with fixes or workarounds, we'll try and get those covered on a future episode of the MacCast. Along with the 10.9.2 update, Apple also did release an update for iTunes 11, iTunes 11 1.5 was released. It fixes a problem that could have caused iTunes to unexpectedly quit when a device was connected, and also reportedly improves compatibility with iBooks for Mac OS X on Mavericks. And those were the only two things noted in the release notes for 11.1.5. As always, you can get all of your software updates by running the Mac App Store and going to the Updates tab, or just running software updates from System Preferences on your Mac. And also, you can always check out apple.com/support for a list of the latest updates from Apple. Over the past several weeks or month or so, we've been hearing a lot of rumors of a Apple TV update coming soon, and a couple of recent events are leading some to believe that Apple may actually bring that out sooner than later. We've already discussed the rumors of a possible Bluetooth game controller and game support being added to the next version of the Apple TV. Well, this week at Apple's shareholder meeting, Tim Cook pointed out that the Apple TV has already made $1 billion in revenue in 2013, and he said it's a little more difficult now to call it a hobby these days. So Apple no longer may be considering the Apple TV to be a hobby, something that they had maintained for a really long time. As a matter of fact, analyst Horace DeDue did some quick math after that call and estimated that the Apple TV is Apple's fastest growing product in terms of sales, up 80% year over year. And Apple just this week started offering a $25 Apple gift card along with the purchase of a new Apple TV at Apple retail stores. That led some people to speculate that Apple was trying to clear out the current model, maybe to make room for a new model. And Bloomberg ran a report suggesting that Apple could put out a new Apple TV as early as April, but the Loop's bearded one, Jim Dalrymple, actually gave that rumor a big old nope. So I would trust Jim on this one and probably not Bloomberg. It's looking like all that's going on is Apple is doing a promotion on the Apple TV, pure and simple, the Apple TV 3, and you can get a $25 gift card. As far as when we'll see a new Apple TV, I think it's something that will drop sometime this year, probably more in that fall time frame. But for now, I think only Apple really has any kind of clue when that's going to happen, and they're certainly not saying. And while they might not be giving us any hints about new hardware, they're certainly continuing to push the content forward on the Apple TV. This week, Apple TV users in the U.S. got a new channel, the WWE World Wrestling Entertainment Channel, which is going to bring 24/7 streaming of wrestling to the set-top box. There's a one-week free trial subscription, but it'll overall cost you $59.99 U.S. for 6 months' access to the content, which includes live pay-per-view events, reality shows, documentaries, and classic matches. And right after the U.S. got WWE, I don't know why that's so hard to say, Apple TV owners in Sweden also got a channel update. They received TV4, which is one of Sweden's largest television networks, with both live and scheduled programming. TV4 is going to have full episodes of their content available for 7 days following their original air date, with certain older content being always available. The HD content apparently is currently limited, but they do say that they're going to be rolling out more HD content on the channel in coming months. So if you haven't checked out your Apple TV lately, you might have some new channels depending upon what part of the world you're in. And then one other thing I want to note, I don't normally talk about app updates, but this or new apps on the show, but this one was significant. Disney released a new app for iOS called Disney Movies Anywhere. I think they actually have the app for Android in a bunch of different places. But the significant thing about the one that they released on the App Store is, one, that it's free. It offers exclusive content as well as original programming and never-before-seen Disney videos to customers. But even cooler is the fact that this app can actually pull in Disney and Marvel iTunes purchase content into the app so that you can actually view your iTunes purchases in a third-party app. And it also has the other way around working for it as well. If you purchase a new Disney movie or Marvel title from the Disney app, it will actually unlock it and push it back into your iTunes account. So Apple has an integration. They've always had a tight relationship with Disney, obviously because of Steve Jobs' relationship with Disney and Pixar. But you can stream or download movies for offline viewing in the Disney app, and everything kind of moves seamlessly back and forth. And best of all, right now, if you download the app and connect it to your iTunes account, they're going to give you a free copy of the Pixar film, The Incredibles. So if you don't already have that in your collection, here's a great way to pick it up for free. And I'm pretty impressed with the app. The whole process worked pretty seamlessly for me. And I think it's really cool. And hopefully we'll see more of this kind of thing happening in the future. I'm not necessarily certain I want two apps. One nice thing I could see for parents with the Disney app is it sort of separates that Disney content. And it does have parental controls in there, so you can kind of set restrictions. So if you have children with iPads or iPhones, you can maybe control more of their video content that they're getting access to. You don't have to give them access to your entire movie library, say, through the Movies app, that sort of thing. So that could be an added benefit. As part of their WWDC announcement, back when Apple announced iOS 7, they talked about their upcoming iBeacon technology, the low-energy Bluetooth technology that was going to allow them to do basically short-range notification sort of things, or location-based notifications using the low-energy Bluetooth technology, and some APIs that developers could take advantage of, things that were built into iOS 7. And that whole system together is what Apple calls iBeacons. Well, the term iBeacon has been being applied to a lot of different low-energy Bluetooth notification systems, but it really is an Apple term. This week, it looks like Apple is now trying to bring that a bit more under control. Developers making devices and products that support Apple's Bluetooth technology can now get an official iBeacon certification from Apple under their Made for i program. So that's the program that allows accessory manufacturers and people who are making devices and products that work with iPhone, iPod, or iPad to get that little logo on their box. They can get it certified with Apple. Apple's extending that to include iBeacon technology. Now, typically within the Made for i program, to be able to use the logo, developers need to pay a per unit fee. At this point, it's not clear if Apple's going to be requiring that royalty for iBeacon certification, because Apple is allowing companies to simply sign up for the program completely free. Now, they do have to sign an NDA. But once they do that, they'll be able to go in and see what the requirements are for certification. Again, what's not clear, though, is in order to get that certification, are they going to have to pay some sort of licensing fee? I'm sure we'll hear more details about the program, but basically I think this is an attempt for Apple to kind of reclaim iBeacon as their term. Like I said, there's a number of other companies developing similar type systems, but the term iBeacon really is something that's exclusively Apple. And then finally in the news for this week, sources at the Financial Times say that Apple is finally getting ready to launch its in-car operating system at this week's Geneva Motor Show. The first models that are actually going to feature the technology are going to be ones that carry a heavy price tag. They're basically what I'm calling the iElite models. Ferrari, Volvo, and Mercedes-Benz are rumored to be the initiative's first partners. The report claims that you will be able to get access to Apple Maps, music, videos, Siri, voice calls, text dictation, and even more through the in-dash systems and infotainment systems that are in those models. So if you're lucky enough to be able to afford one of those cars in the new, I would assume, 2015 editions, then it sounds like you're going to get some cool tech that'll integrate with your iOS devices, something I know a lot of us have wanted for a really long time. I've personally been envious of the technology that's been in the Ford model, specifically the Microsoft Sync technology. Now, interestingly, over the past week or so, it was announced that Ford is reportedly dropping Microsoft Sync for, of all things, BlackBerry technology. It actually is good news for BlackBerry, as it's being said it could help sort of prop up and save BlackBerry from extinction. I guess they have some really nice embedded systems technology that's used in a number of applications. I think it's called the QNX. I'm probably getting the acronym wrong. It's either QNX or QXN technology from BlackBerry. But what I'm really hoping with Apple's in-car operating system is that hopefully the program and integration works so well in those higher-end models that it ends up being quickly adopted by other car manufacturers that have offerings that are maybe more in my budget range for new vehicles. And I would hope that at some point there's some third-party systems, some aftermarket systems that can be incorporated and actually also include the technology from Apple. But I haven't heard anything about or related to that. But it's good to finally see that Apple's making some progress forward in the whole in-car initiative. You know, they had that Series i-free thing for a while, but it never really seemed to have taken off. And it sounds like this is the next big push for iOS in the car, and we might hear a little bit more about it at this week's Geneva Motor Show. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Kicking off the feedback, we have a couple of stories to follow up on, some things that we've been talking about or we were talking about a couple shows back. The first one being Mac databases. I had a listener who was looking to find a database that he could use for managing a group that he was in charge of and was wondering what to do now that we've lost Bento, specifically since FileMaker is a bit expensive if you're trying to run just a small group, something like that. And I talked about some of the database options that you might have, doing things like SQLite or MySQL. Well, our friend Bart Bouchatz from the Let's Talk Mac podcast actually wrote me with some great comments and recommendations. He pointed out that SQLite is a good choice because it's actually serverless, meaning that you don't have to do any complicated server install. You just have a file, and you can use an application like Navicat Essentials for SQLite, which is $6.99 US on the Mac App Store. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. You can use that as a GUI application to actually create and manage your SQLite database files. I already mentioned MySQL when I was giving my recommendations, and I use Navicat for MySQL to manage that, but that's about a $100 program. It's going to set you back $100 US, and that's a bit pricey for some people. Bart actually recommends, if you're going to go the MySQL route, that you check out SQL Pro, which is a free GUI application, actually his favorite one for managing MySQL databases. But he also pointed out that I ignored his favorite database on the Mac, PostgreSQL. Is that how you say it? I think probably I didn't recommend it because I never know how to pronounce the darn thing. Postgres or PostgreSQL. And he said what he likes about it is you don't even need to set up or run a big complex server application because there's an app called Postgre.app or Postgres.app that will allow you to do it from a menu bar item. So you just launch the application and boom, you've got a PostgreSQL instance up and running that you can work with. And I'll have a link to all of this stuff in the show notes at maccast.com. About the only disadvantage with using databases like SQLite, MySQL, or Postgres is that you don't have a way to actually, say, create forms, do those sorts of things. You actually have to build that stuff with web interfaces or using some other kinds of technologies that are actually going to interface with your database. So at that point, as many people said and pointed out to me, is why even bother with a database at all for maintaining a group? How about just using a spreadsheet application, something like Excel or Numbers? And I guess for that, it really depends on what your needs are. The really nice thing about Bento and relational databases was that they had interfaces where you could create different forms and views, and you could kind of cross-link everything together and really take advantage of the power of a relational database. And you're not going to be able to do that very easily just using a spreadsheet application. So I guess another and maybe the best and final option would be to just use a dedicated site that manages the type of group that you have. So something like meetup.com is really convenient, or Shutterfly has some good stuff for managing sports teams, or a website like eTeams. There's all kinds of specialized sort of SaaS, I guess, service in the cloud sort of sites that will allow you to manage different groups and members and things like that. And some of them even have some great iOS apps for doing things like check-ins and barcode scanning and all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of options out there if you just do a little exploring. But I still think what it comes back down to is we really need a good, simple replacement for Bento database on the Mac and on our iOS devices. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like anybody's come up with anything, or at least I haven't heard of anything. So if you know of a good application that works as a Bento replacement, we're still kind of looking for that sort of thing. Let us know about it, mattcast@gmail.com. Another thing that came up on a recent episode of the MacCast is we had a Windows switcher, someone coming over to the Mac from Windows, ask about flash drives, and specifically a way to have it in one step when you remove a file from a flash drive, rather than going into the trash and sitting there until you empty it, to actually behave more like it does on Windows, where once you delete the item, it actually completely removes it from the flash drive, freeing up the space. And I didn't know a way to actually force the delete to happen all in one step, but I did cover a way to actually use Automator to create a service that would allow you to basically access from the Finder the Unix RM or remove command that would normally be accessed from the command line just through the services menu to actually accomplish a similar sort of thing. So you could select the items that were on the flash drive, use the service, and it would actually delete them directly rather than going through the trash and having to do that whole two-step process, put into the trash and then empty the trash. Well, Jill wrote in and said that there's another trick you can use. And the key here is to, quote-unquote, prep the USB stick so that it thinks it has a trashes folder, the .trashes folder, which is the little secret folder that exists on each volume to kind of store the trash contents, to make it think it has one of those folders when it actually really doesn't. And more importantly, prevent it from recreating a .trashes folder. So what you can do is you can actually insert your flash drive, mount it on the Mac, and then in the Finder, just copy over a file onto the flash drive, and then move that file to the trash. Don't empty the trash, but just leave it sitting there in the trash so you've got the trash file created and it's there. Now, remove the flash stick, eject it from your Mac, and insert it into a Windows PC, because on the PC side, you're actually going to be able to see all of the little hidden files that the Mac puts onto that drive. Now, if you're handy in the terminal on the Mac and you're not afraid of going in there, you actually could do this trick from the command line on the Mac, or just use a Mac or use an app on the Mac, rather, a third-party app that will actually show and allow you to access the hidden files. But what you're going to do is this sneaky little trick of deleting every file, every one of those invisible files, and replacing it with an empty folder of the same name, and then deleting every folder and replacing it with a zero-byte file of the same name. So you're basically putting placeholders, these empty placeholders in place of the actual items that the Finder created, these little invisible, I think they're all .dot files. So the key one being, I would assume, the .dot trashes file. And then once you've done that, you're good to go. You can eject that from the PC and then put it in your Mac. And now when you use the move to trash option or try and put stuff into the trash, it will not allow you to put it in the trash. The Mac will actually warn you that it's unable to move those items to the trash and ask you if you would like to delete them instead, which is exactly what this user was trying to do. So you just say, yep, go ahead, delete them. I don't really care. And again, the trick works because you removed those special files from Mac OS X and you put in place some files with exactly the same name, so the system actually can't recreate those. So that's a great little hack, a great little trick, and thanks, Jill, for sending that one in. Now, I'm going to throw a bonus little Windows switcher tip in for you, because Daniel recently moved over to the Mac and he wanted to know how he could check a number of files together to see how much disk space they use on the hard drive. So basically in the Finder, being able to select a number of files, X number of files, and get info on them so that you can see them all in aggregate. How much space do they all take up together? And the reason he brought this up was he was trying to select the items in the Finder and use the get info option, command I, but If you do that, what happens is you get a separate window for each file that indicates the information like file size and all those sorts of things. So the question is, how can you group all those together and get one total amount? Well, it turns out, Daniel, that it's relatively simple. You just use the option trick. So you hold down the option key when you choose File, Get Info. And what you'll notice in the Finder when you go under the File menu and hold down the Option key is that the Get Info option will turn to Show Inspector. If you'd like to do it in a keyboard shortcut, it's just Command Option I instead of Command I. And when you use that, you will get one info dialog that is the aggregate of all of the files that you selected. So you'll get the total file size for all the files in that group. And as a matter of fact, in OS X Mavericks, this can also be a handy way to add tags to a group of various files and folders. So if you want to give the same tag to a bunch of different items within the Finder, you could do this trick, open them up in the Inspector, and then set the tag for all of those items right there in the Show Inspector window. So I hope that helps you out, Daniel, and thanks for the question. As we discussed earlier, the Mac OS X 10.9.2 update fixed a number of bugs and issues in OS X Mavericks, but just after the release of the update, Justin emailed me to say that there is a long-standing OS X Mavericks bug that still exists and could impact you if you are using FireWire drives with your Mac. Now, apparently since the release of Mac OS X 10.9, FireWire hard drives, external FireWire hard drives hooked up to your Mac will not spin down even when your Mac goes to sleep. And this is despite any setting that you might have in System Preferences Energy Saver. So even if you have the put hard disks to sleep when possible option checked, FireWire hard drives still will not spin down. And indeed, I was able to verify this behavior in 10.9.2 because I recently hooked up an old Seagate FireWire 800 drive that I had to use as my super duper backup drive. And after Justin emailed me, I reached over and I just put my hand on it. And sure enough, it was just spinning full bore constantly and not shutting down. And it never shut down. The other thing I noticed was it was a little bit warm to the touch, more warm than I normally would like it to be. Now, unfortunately, the only workarounds that I can think of for dealing with this issue would be to, one, power off your Mac when you're not using it, because cutting power to the FireWire drive is the only way to get it to spin down. You could also eject and disconnect the FireWire drive when you're not using it, but if you're using that external drive for backups, say, any kind of scheduled tasks, that's really not going to help. So the next thing that I wondered about was, well, how bad is it or isn't it to just let the drive spin constantly at full speed? And when I went to do the research on this, as are a lot of things in technology, the debate seems to be evenly split between experts on both sides saying that one way is better than the other. And so to me, it really feels very similar to a debate that we've had on the MacCast in the past, and I get asked about a lot, is should I shut down my computer at night or should I leave it on? Which is better? And really, I think it just comes down to what you're comfortable with. I'm not sure that one is necessarily better than the other. And I'm going to spare you the arguments on both sides for the whole, you know, do you let hard drives spin down or not spin down sorts of things, and just sort of highlight some of the advantages and disadvantages that I discovered as I was doing the research, and then let you decide for yourself what you want to do. Ultimately, I decided that I'll just wait for Apple to issue an update, but I'm going to continue to use the FireWire drive and just let it spin all the time. And here's the deal. Spinning up and down of the drive does add wear and tear to the motor. So it's just like starting up and shutting down your car constantly. Every time you start it up, things are going to have to grind up and get going, and it's going to put extra stress and strain on the motor. But the thing is that most of today's modern hard drives are built to take that kind of shut down and start up, you know, that sequence. It's understood that they're going to have to go through that process hundreds of thousands of times, or thousands of times rather, over the life of the drive. And so it's planned in the operation, and when the manufacturers pick the components, that's what's going to happen. So you're very unlikely to actually wear it out in normal use with letting the hard drive spin up and spin down. So normally that would be an argument for, well, let it, you know, leave it on all the time, because then you're not going to put wear and tear on the motor. But not spinning down the drive potentially puts wear and tear on the drive bearings. You're going to be constantly spinning the disc, so the bearings could potentially wear out. But once again, they're rated for being in use in most branded, you know, good quality hard drives. It's going to be understood that you're going to be using the disc and it's going to be spinning a lot. So with those two things, it's, you know, in my mind, sort of a draw. You know, you can either potentially wear out your motor or potentially wear out your bearings. Both, if they wear out, are going to be bad, going to be bad things ultimately. Another thing to note is that drives that need to wake up or spin up are going to be a little bit slower the first time you try and access them. So if it's sitting there asleep and you need to access that data on the drive, we've all had this experience, right? You hear the click whirr, and then you see the beach ball as it's waiting for that to come up to speed so that it can actually access the data on the drive. That's just the facts of sort of how these things work. So some people don't want to have their drives spin down so that they can actually access them very quickly. Drives that are spun down, though, use less energy. Now, how much less energy is probably up for debate. I mean, overall, especially if you're using a laptop drive that's maybe just getting, you know, 5 volts of power, it's powered off the bus, it's not going to be using a whole ton of energy even when it's powered on. But that is a consideration. If you're really concerned about energy usage or maybe battery drain on your Mac, then maybe you do want to let them spin down. Now, not spinning down the drive, as I noted earlier, also can cause the drive to run hotter, and we know that heat is not necessarily good for drives. So if you are going to have a drive that's spinning constantly, you're probably going to want to make sure that it's in an environment where it can get cooled, where it's got airflow around it, where it's got some way to actually dissipate heat. But like I said, the experts don't even agree on this. The last thing I'll leave you with, though, was something that I read in a PC Magazine article from Steve Gibson. You may recognize that name. Steve Gibson develops a hard drive testing and repair suite called SpinRite. It's actually one of those things that is said to be able to resurrect what most people think are dead hard drives. Unfortunately, it only works on the PC side of the world, so you got to get a Windows box to actually work with it. But I've heard great things about it. So Steve is an expert in hard drive and hard drive technology and hard drive recovery. And he says that cycling the drive, turning it off and on, is definitely worse for it than keeping it spinning all the time. So I'm going to go with Steve's, you know, sort of thoughts on this one and not worry too much about the hard drive not spinning down. I've been running mine for about a week now, and knock on wood, I haven't had issues. But Justin, if you're still concerned, you're going to have to deal with some of the workarounds until Apple actually releases a fix for it. And it's not even clear, as you noted in your email to me, if Apple will actually fix this, because FireWire is sort of on the way out with Apple replacing it with Thunderbolt. I think, though, if enough people mentioned to Apple that they would like them to fix this, so I would go to Apple's feedback site, give them feedback. Apple.com/feedback, I believe, is the URL. Just let them know, and hopefully they will patch it maybe in 10.9.3. So I think it happens about once a quarter or so, maybe more frequently. You can tell me if you're a religious listener to the MacCast, but I need to take some time and talk about the App Store and why it seems to continue to rhyme with the word flappy. And of course, my reference is to Flappy Bird. Mac Rumors reported this week that over a 24-hour period, from Wednesday to Thursday, one-third of the new games submitted to the App Store were actually Flappy Bird clones. So of all the new games submitted, a third of them are just simply trying to leverage and take advantage of the whole Flappy Bird getting removed hype that's been going on. And I mention this because I see this as just as a symptom of this bigger problem that the App Store has had for forever. And it's actually a larger problem that comes from just the popularity of apps and Apple's whole App Store ecosystem. And it's breeding this sort of issue that just kind of grinds my gears every once in a while when I read a story like this. And unfortunately, it's proving the old adage of careful what you wish for. If you go back and listen to some older MacCasts, I remember when Apple announced they were doing the whole App Store thing, and I think specifically I mentioned this in reference to Apple bringing an App Store to the Mac, but I talked about the fact that with how popular iOS devices and iPhones and things like that were, that I was concerned we were going to end up with an application ecosystem that mirrored what Windows users had for years and years and years. And that's where there is a ton of software available, but that a vast majority of it is just junk. And I've been around long enough to remember the Mac days when we had quality software and we had that versus quantity. And there was this whole quality versus quantity debate. And Windows users would always claim that their platform was more superior because they had a lot of choice when it came to applications. And we would argue back that, you know what, we have the best applications in terms of quality, so we don't really need quantity because we have fewer choices, yet the choices that we do have are much better in terms of I don't have to worry one app versus another whether or not it's going to be a good app, right? We just sort of had good apps. And that's not to say we didn't have some bad applications out there, but on a percentage basis, you know, I can remember that there were a lot of apps in different categories where it was like, well, you can get this one from this developer or that one from that developer or that one from that developer. They're all good. You just got to figure out the slight differences and variances between the three of them and figure out which one is the best fit for you. And that was a great position to be in. And now we're in this situation where there is so much junk that just finding the good app, unless you know about it already, is practically impossible. And it's only getting worse when things like this whole Flappy Bird thing happens and everybody starts gaming the system. All these sort of unscrupulous, just slimy developers that are out there start messing with the system. So I really still believe in the advantages of a few great apps versus hundreds of mediocre ones sort of mucking up the system. And, you know, I know you can argue that having a vibrant app store ecosystem with more developers in it, more people wanting to develop for the platform, is going to just raise up and bring more quality apps. But personally, I don't feel like it's happening proportionally with the number of just junk applications that are in there. The app numbers rise, but the portion of quality apps that I see doesn't seem to rise at nearly the same rate as the quantity of just garbage. And more, it seems like we're getting these developers who are just looking to make a quick buck. They're lying, cheating, downright stealing in some cases to actually make that happen. And as a matter of fact, as proof of that, another story that kind of came up this past week or so is TechCrunch reported on a developer who has been making tens of thousands of dollars a day from an app that was just bought off of a $10 app theme. I didn't even know such a thing existed, but apparently you can go out and just get an app already written for a really low price, just like a little template, tweak it a little bit, adjust it, and then throw it into the App Store and call it your own. And in this case, the template was called Red Bouncing Ball Spikes. And it, at one point, became the number two paid app, iPhone app, on the App Store. And how? Well, the guy scammed the system. You know, and he wasn't doing anything wrong in this case. It wasn't any kind of hacking. He was actually just leveraging the system itself to his own personal gain. And what the developer did, reportedly, was buy his own app to get it up into the top 10. And you might be thinking, well, that's got to be a really expensive way to go. And this developer was reportedly has a reputation for actually doing a lot of these bad, nefarious things, like ripping off other developers, stealing games, stealing source code, those sorts of things. But what he did in this case was he created thousands of fake iTunes accounts, about 20,000 to be exact, and then just bought copies of his own application at 99 cents. So he spent $20,000 up front to buy these apps. But remember, he's the developer. It's his app. So he's actually going to get 70% of that investment back. So he's not even spending $20,000, spending a lot less than that. But apparently $20,000 is that sort of, you know, selling $20,000 worth of an app is enough to get it these days into the top list, kind of the top 10 list of featured apps, what have you. And then I guess once there, naturally, the app, just by being popular, is going to get tens of thousands of purchases a day. So you spend 20 grand up front, and you're going to be making 20, 30, 40, 50 grand a day as long as you can keep the app up there. So you can see you don't have to keep it up for very long to actually make a lot of money doing this sort of thing. But the point is that just mucks up the system for everybody else, right? How are we supposed to find what apps are truly popular if developers are just pushing their own apps by buying them themselves into those lists? Worthless. And if you look at the top games list, you know, it's all loaded with the Flappy Bird clones now. It's so incredibly frustrating to me. And so as long as Apple's devices and the App Store remains popular, I think this is going to kind of be the new world we live in. So maybe we just have to learn to sort of navigate around it and you know, through listening to podcasts and this show and other shows like it, I guess we can figure out what the good apps are. But it just doesn't sit well with me. I long for the old days. Maybe I'm just being curmudgeonly again, and I know I do that from time to time on the show. But, you know, I guess I can hope that that hopefully by talking about it and mentioning it and complaining to Apple about it, that Apple becomes more aware that these scams are going on and that the gaming is happening, and will work a little bit harder to kind of shut it down and make the ecosystem more useful for us, right? And so far, it seems like they aren't doing that. And my gut tells me that the problem is that they're just woefully understaffed and overwhelmed by all of these apps that get submitted each and every day. So like the app review process, all that sort of stuff, that team is just really overwhelmed. But you'd think this would be a good area for Apple to invest a few billion of those hundreds of billions of dollars of cash on hand that they have to kind of clean this junk up. You know, I can hope that they're going to put money into it, but I just don't think they will. I mean, they're making a lot of money off this stuff, and hand over fist, Apple makes money from the bad apps as much as they make money from the good apps. And that may just, again, be the reality that we're in. So I guess I'll just continue to turn to other sources, things like Appler, getappler.com. I think we've talked about that on the show. That's Michael Johnston's site that he built, where we can actually go and make recommendations to each other, and you can follow people you respect on there and see what apps they're buying and what they like and get comments and things like that. I think that's much more useful way to find out about applications than just trying to troll the top 10 lists in the App Store, which are completely worthless. Okay, I think that's enough of that rant over. I'm sure you've got some comments on this sort of thing as well. Shoot me some email. I'd love to hear your feedback. MacCast@gmail.com. Now, Katie wrote in with a macOS 10 Mavericks mail bug, something that was not addressed with the latest update and something I had not heard of before, but one that I also see in my mail. And this is related to the junk mail filter, something that I really rely on in Apple Mail. But unfortunately, the problem seems to be that while messages are getting moved over to the junk mail folder, junk messages, you know, like the actual messages, and every once in a while, you know, a false positive will slip through, and this is actually what Katie was having some issue with, is that if you go and look in OS X Mavericks in the junk mail folder, even though the messages get moved over, some of them are not being tagged with the junk mail brown color or the little junk mail icon. And what this means is that if you do get a false positive in your junk mail folder, you can't simply select it in the junk mail and then click the little, you know, thumbs up to say, hey, this is not junk, and get it back into your inbox. Now, as a workaround, what I've been doing is just dragging the junk mail, the false positive, from the junk mail box back into my inbox. And you can even use a David Sparks trick and move it into the mailbox list bar, the little inbox that's right up there in the bar. It saves you a little bit of dragging, and drop it onto the inbox there. I will point out, for those of you who might be thinking, well, that feature was broken, you know, the whole universal inbox was broken in OS X Mavericks as well. That was fixed in 10.9.2. So it used to be in Lion, Mountain Lion, if you took a message and you put it into the universal inbox, it would find its way to the correct inbox based on, you know, where it started out from. That broke in 10.9, but is fixed in 10.9.2. So you can go back to using that little trick. But other than doing that sort of workaround, Katie, I guess the other thing that you could do to you know, sort of mark it from the junk mail folder as not being junk is simply select the one that didn't get marked, give it the thumbs down, which will mark it, and give it the brown color, and give it the little icon in the junk mail folder, and then immediately give it the thumbs up to say this is not junk. The only thing I worry about there is I don't know what would happen in Apple's little algorithm if it would suddenly consider that to be junk and give you more false positives, so I might be a little bit leery about using that one. But I really hadn't run across or noticed this issue before. It's definitely there for me. Maybe it's there for some of you. If you're experiencing it and have a better workaround or some other suggestion for us, let us know about it. Shoot us an email or an audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com. And then finally for this week, I need to bring up something that I was aware of at one time but had sort of forgotten about, related to Time Machine and iPhoto. And this week a listener emailed to remind me about this problem, and I thought we could all use a reminder about it because it could potentially lead to data loss, to people losing some of their photos in iPhoto, and that's definitely something we don't want to have happen. Now, I know all of you listen to the MacCast, so you probably have backups, so you're maybe a little bit better protected, but your friends and family members could get hit by this. And what it is that back in the day, pre-iPhoto 9.2, in iPhoto, if you were using Time Machine, there was a browse backups option. And this was really cool because you could actually activate Time Machine when you had iPhoto open. And rather than going into the Finder, what it would do is it would give you the iPhoto interface all layered up like Time Machine. And you could go back within an individual album, within your library, at any point within iPhoto, and go back and recover, say, a accidentally deleted photo, just the one photo, and bring it back. And that's what this listener wanted to do. But what he discovered is that after iPhoto 9.2, Apple changed how the system works. And the reason is that with the 9.2 update, Apple moved iPhoto to have, or changed iPhoto so that it just has a single iPhoto library file. So if you go look at your iPhoto library, it's no longer a folder with a bunch of subfolders in it. What it looks like is just one single file. Now, the reality is that is a package file, and it actually has the folder structure still contained within it, but apparently iPhoto can't distinguish that anymore. So Apple has a support article that says you will now be taken, when you activate Time Machine and you have iPhoto open, you're going to be taken into the Finder to where the iPhoto library file is, and you have to just restore the entire iPhoto library file. You can't go back and just grab an individual image. You're going to have to go back in time to whenever you think you had that version of the iPhoto library, and bring the entire thing back. The huge problem with this, and I think you're probably already seeing this, is that it's going to want to overwrite your existing photo library, meaning that you could lose all of your images from that point forward. That is a huge problem. Now, I would assume that Time Machine is going to do its regular thing and ask you, hey, do you want to overwrite the existing file that's there? Do you want to keep both of them? And of course, the answer is, please keep both of them. But what happens if you don't have enough space? iPhoto libraries can be huge, so you might not have enough disk space to actually keep both items. And I have a feeling there's going to be a large number of people that aren't going to understand that, hey, I could be potentially overwriting a bunch of my images by restoring this file. So to me, this is just a huge problem and something that Apple needs to address. They really need to bring back that functionality where we can go back within Time Machine in the iPhoto interface and get an individual item. It was cool functionality, and there's no reason why it couldn't work anymore because, again, that library file is just a package with those same folders. As a matter of fact, if you go into the Finder and you control click or right click on the iPhoto library and choose Show Package Contents, you can see all of that information. And so the one workaround or hack around that I can think of, if you just need to go back in Time Machine and get an individual photo, would be to leverage the fact that you can show the package contents. So go to your home folder, pictures, to the iPhoto library file, right click on it, and choose Show Package Contents. That's going to put you inside the package, and what you'll see in there is there's a folder alias called Originals. Click on that, and then you should see a bunch of folders organized by year. At that point, you can activate Time Machine and you can browse back within that folder structure to find the image that you want to restore. Now, be aware, as you drill down through year, you're going to see folders sorted by month or folders with the month numbers, and then you'll see folders with the day numbers. After that, within each one of those, it starts to get a little trickier because you'll have a bunch of cryptic folder names, or most likely cryptic folder names, and image names that are just like hashes that are just a bunch of numbers. But you can use the preview functionality or the quick look functionality inside the Finder to kind of find the image that you maybe need to restore. So you're going to have to do some hunting and pecking. But at that point, you can select it. You can use the standard Time Machine functionality to actually restore the image. I would still create a duplicate, you know, have it keep the original and then just pull the original out of the iPhoto library to kind of save it off if you have an original already in place. So maybe you're just trying to replace a corrupted image. And I would also absolutely make sure before trying this that I have a full backup of my iPhoto library just in case things go south or you have a problem. But that's about the only way I can think of to restore the image until Apple actually decides to give us the selective restore functionality of Time Machine back in iPhoto. And I really hope that they ultimately decide to bring that functionality back, although they obviously haven't over several iterations and updates of iPhoto. So maybe that's just a bunch of wishful thinking on my part. But with that, I think that is going to do it for this week's MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen Scan Plus, and Text Expander Touch for your iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of the Smile software over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. Talked about a lot of stuff today. I'd love to get some of your comments and feedback on that or any other topics that you want to talk about. Also, if you have something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me email. MacCast@gmail.com is the address. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. Also, check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And you can find us on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast over there, and it should pop right up. Pretty much, I'm MacCast everywhere online. So if you search for MacCast, you're very likely going to find me. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.